The Buddha tells us that there are three characteristics of this realm, and that these characteristics are to be penetrated, they're to be understood directly through insight, not conceptually understood alone, not intellectually understood alone, but actually in that felt sense way that, oh, this is really true. And that's the level of insight. And I describe insight as like a flash of lightning, as opposed to you've really figured something out over a period of time. It's like, ah, that's what he meant. Ah, I get it. And we have insights over and over again till it becomes like a truth to us. It becomes, we just know it. We just know it. And these characteristics, it's sort of are like the water we swim in. They're always there, so we don't necessarily know them because they're always there. Why would we have brought our attention to them? And one of these three is the anicca, which is that things are always changing. Everything that is made up of parts is always changing. So everything that is constructed is always changing. And then the second of these is dukkha, this feeling of unsatisfactoriness of life, of stress of life, that there's a kind of pressure. I prefer pressure to stress because stress is actually a mental reaction to pressure. It's not, and then I have a whole article that you can go to Dharma Wisdom or lifebalance.org and read about the difference between pressure and stress, which is very useful, by the way, in terms of being mindful of that difference. Because we fall into stress a lot of times when there was an option and we missed that there was an option because we were misperceiving the pressure. And we thought, oh, this is stressful because it's in now to feel stress. And so we go to stressful thinking and we actually create the world that then we suffer from. So it's worth focusing on, but that's not the subject today. So dukkha is this stressfulness. It's sometimes modern day's term distress, not my favorite word, but unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, unreliableness, this feeling of that it's suffering, that it's suffering, it's unease. And that's because, in part, everything's always changing. So, in part, we always have to be alert since everything's changing. And it turns out we can't control, we can't stop those things we like the way they are from changing. And if we think we're supposed to be able to, that is stressful because we're trying to do something that can't be done. So it's a sure defeat in that way. And then the third of these is anatta or anatta, this not-selfness, that what so much that we think is self is not actually me and mine in that way. That's not the subject of this weekend either. But movement, since movement has a beginning and a middle and an end, it's very much part of anicca. That every individual movement is part of Nietzsche. But movement itself is simply the characteristic of the realm. The sticky wicket in all this is that our very, who we are is subject to Nietzsche. I was talking about the inner committee earlier, that we all have an inner committee. There's a whole group of us inside that have slightly different values and different moods. And there's just this different perspective. And what we see is that over any given time frame, what we're noticing or how we're feeling about what we're noticing changes tremendously. So there's this constant, inner change. And so how do we organize? Since there's these different ones of us inside that would sort of, and I'm not meaning to suggest we're multiple personalities or any of that, that's a whole another world, but it's literally these little different aspects of us have different values and different emphasis. So How do we respond wisely? How do we learn what to do? How do we show up in this constant inner movement in a way that has some sort of a well-being to it, a kind of stillness of intent in the midst of all of this moving? I'm not sure how good a job I did with that, describing the dilemma. You've sort of got a feel for the dilemma. It's a dilemma. Here's what T.S. Eliot says in the Four Quartets about this, and most of you that have been here with me before know I often refer to the Four Quartets because it's one of the, in my view, great pieces of literature that deals with the inner life, with the spiritual life, with the perplexities of all of these things. Just to give you a feel for that, I intended to do this, but I'll do it anyway. That's my intent in this very moment is to read something else, but okay. He starts out, time present and time past are both perhaps present and time future. And time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. This is saying that we have no choice, that everything's already preordained. There's a man in Mumbai that named Ramesh, who's written great books on this subject about how there is no freedom, that it's already conditioned all out, and it's already done, and we're just watching it unfold, but there's no freedom in that. That's been presented many times by many people, including my godson just a couple weekends ago, who was telling me, we don't really have any choice in life. There is really no freedom. He's all of 18 years old, and he's concluded this, and it was affecting his life. It was affecting his life. It made life seem less. I hold that there is a small degree of choice. So small, but it makes all the difference. Without there being choice, I don't really think that the Buddha's teachings hold together. So I think that there's a real assumption in that. And that Eliot would be addressing all of these things is quite remarkable, quite remarkable. And you know what sampling is in music. He samples every spiritual tradition. So there's one I'll maybe read to you today or tomorrow about all is well and all manner of things shall be well that he took from this Christian mystic of the 13th century, Dame Julian of Norwich. And so he samples all of these people and he brings all of their little nuggets of wisdom into something that seems like one continuous self-conversation with himself. And that's why I bother to say all that to you. And here he is talking about this dilemma that I brought up with you. Since we're always changing inside, what do we do? And he starts out setting up the dilemma. When the train starts, now you're a passenger on this train. Imagine you're on this train going through Europe or something, or going down to Portland, as far as that matter goes. When the train starts and the passengers are settled to fruit, periodicals, and business letters, and those who sell them off have left the platform, their faces relax from grief into relief to the sleepy rhythm of 100 hours. Fare forward, voyagers, not escaping from the past into different lives or into any future, repeating, not escaping from the past into different lives or into any future. You are not the same people who left that station or who will arrive at any terminus. The idea of our, this is the anatta, the not self aspect. There's not that permanency, which is very alarming when we first meet of it in some way. You're not the same person who left that station who will arrive at any terminus while the narrowing rails slide together behind you And on the deck of the drumming liner, being on a boat, and on the deck of the drumming liner, watching the furrow that widens behind you. Isn't this beautiful imagery? The boat with creating the wake behind it. Just like the narrowing rails sliding. And on the deck of the drumming liner, watching the furrow that widens behind you, you shall not think the past is finished or the future is before us. At nightfall in the rigging in the aerial is a voice decanting, though not to the ear, the mummering shell of time, and not in any language. Fare forward, you who think you are voyaging. You are not those who saw the harbor receding or those who will disembark. And then he gets to the point of, so what can you realize? Here between hither and the farther shore, while time is withdrawn, as it's done on retreat this weekend. Here, while time is withdrawn, consider the future and the past with an equal mind. At the moment, which is not of action or inaction, you can receive this. On whatever sphere of being the mind of a person may be intent at the time of death, that is the one action, and the time of death is every moment which shall fructify in the lives of others. And do not think of the fruit of action. Fare forward, O voyagers. I will say to people at the end of a one-on-one on residential not retreats, fare forward, voyager. So his point is that in this very moment is when we can make a difference. In this very moment. We are only in this moment. There's not any, okay, over this arc of time, I'm going to make all this difference. Because sometimes, you know, the irritated one is there with your five-year-old. And she's not, she's got, you know, you've got this clear agenda for a five-year-old. But in this moment, the version of you that's there as mom is just irritated and doesn't do the thing that would, that you've got this campaign to help the five-year-old not act this certain way. And that's not who shows up. So it's in this moment is what matters. And the more we get clear on our values, the more we have this ongoing cultivation of that integrity that I was pointing out to you, the more we're able in that moment to have wise choice. No matter what our personality is present, in this moment we have clarity of purpose and clarity of intent. We're clear on our goal. We're clear on our intent. Now, we may not be feeling like that at all. The personality that's here is like, you know, just go to your room and leave me alone. But no, we have some degree of choice because we have this integrity, this clarity of goal and purpose, and then the clarity of intent. There's an integrity to us. And that moment to moment is the connection. It's moment to moment. It's not permanent. It's renewed over and over again. It's renewed over and over again, and it becomes habitual for us to make that renewal over and over again. It becomes habitual. We've showed up for ourselves so much that we're here. This presence, the mindfulness starts to be, the mindfulness is what's connecting the moment. And we've built a base of ourselves to live wisely. I find this to be true. I find this to be true. And I've worked with a lot of people now, and the people that work in this way, it seems to work that out. And then the other part of that is the movement of the mind, our views and opinions, which have so much movement in them, you know, like we're riled up or we're dispirited or we we're frustrated or, you know, well, this movement of mind in all of these different ways, it deceives us. It deceives us. We take the feeling that that of the mind in that moment to be what we really care about. And it's just what we care about right now because we're irritated with, you know, the plane not leaving on time or the traffic or, you know, one more robocall on the telephone, whatever it is that we're irritated about or what we don't have in our lives. and we start acting from our resentment of our loneliness rather than acting from what we really care about. And if we were far more able to attend to that loneliness if we start acting from what we really care about, but that comes secondarily to what I'm pointing to now. And so this integrity and all, the to seeing stillness and being able to access the stillness, what's really true for me? So we, this moment, we're still in this moment. We're not being just prompted through this moment by the stimuli of the moment. No, there's a, that we, that it's going on and we're participating in it. And there's this stillness that knows. It knows what we're really about. That's the moment of choice when we have that stillness. Like, oh no, I really know what I'm about here. And it's not what this moment stimulation is generating. And so that integrity gives us a sense of well-being, even if the stimulation of the moment is not giving us well-being at all. It's given us, you know, a feeling of defeat or physical pain or emotional pain or total confusion and chaos, whatever it is, that there's a through line. There's something that we're being true to through the connection that's what matters, is that through line of what we're about in that way. This I am suggesting is, this is my suggestion, that this is part of the wise use of mindfulness and why the Buddha points to the kind of happiness that's not based on conditions. So with that as a context, to the group as a whole here, and it's just for a few minutes before we break for lunch, question, or if you were in the group already and you had a chance to ask up.
It's all there.
Yes.
Like the one that gets this is available.
Yeah. Yeah, so I teach this, the earth element in the lower half of the body quite regularly because thousands of people now have discovered that if they find that stillness of letting earth element rest on earth, and that whole thing that you really can learn to, you can really learn stillness. The principle is that the earth is more still. And again, everything's relative. So otherwise somebody wants to say, no, that's not really still at all. So, relatively still. And then you're resting in that stillness, like the body rests on earth, your mind's resting on that stillness. And then you realize, oh, that capacity of resting, the mind resting, attention resting on something can apply to movement. The movement moves, but if I rest on the knowing doesn't move. The moving's going through the knowing, but it's the knowing itself isn't moving. And then boom. Oh, so you had stillness and movement and walking.
Yes.
Isn't that beautiful?
Like
yeah, it's really great. Thank you for that. Others, about your experience of practice. And yeah. Now there's great comfort in this. And it's the truth. But it's our access that gets blocked, not the truth. So that the pause, if you will just pause in the walking, then it actually, you are able to stay more present to the movement. It's ironic that would be true, but what's happening is we're collecting ourselves. And this is something we need to do all day long, is develop a pause where we can collect ourselves, catch up with ourselves is the other phrase I use. Because we get behind our stimulant. And we live such stimulating lives, even though you may think your life is boring or something, it's actually got so much stimulation hitting it all the time that we kind of get a bit apart from ourselves. So that pause allows us to catch up or recollect ourselves. There's a remembering aspect, and that remembering is literally like putting ourselves back together, connecting the flow, the water element of ourselves, so that Yeah. So, you know, dancers are having, they're having all those experiences, but they're not necessarily being mindful of them the way that that we would be in this practice, but they're having all of that experience all the time. And you go, wow, no wonder they love dancing so much, because they're, you know, a professional dancer, someone or any person that's really into it in that way. And sometimes they have the mindfulness, but often not. That was one of the things that shocked me, is that people who can do great movement are not necessarily present for the movement. They don't have the awe. You know, I can have awe over their ability to move, and I can feel the connection, and they just take it as normal. So they don't have, there's no awe associated with it. It's very interesting. But yeah, so you're coming into, that's what it's feeling like in the moment, to be in the moment. And you're, when you're having a beginner's mind in the moment, like you were 5 years old, you're discovering, but you have the advantage of being an adult, and so you know you are, and you know you have this much greater connection to it. Thank you for that. So we'll take an hour for lunch. We'll come back at 1:30.